What's that mean? Non-ending the fellowship. It means body, mind, and spirit all in one. It means I've got all my parts walking around in the same set of shoes. It means that I'm integrated. Finally, I have integrity. It means that these three pieces of it, the unity that Bob talked about, the service that Keith is going to talk about, and the recovery, which is this piece of it, taken together are very, very precious and very impactful on our lives. And it's awful hard to talk about recovery without talking about the steps. Unity, we have the 12 traditions, service, the 12 service concepts, and the base of it, the recovery, is the 12 steps. Interesting, these 12 steps. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had the idea that I was supposed to adopt them. You know, you come in here, you plead guilty to alcoholism, you pledge allegiance to the steps, and it isn't quite like that, really. And how many people are like me that grew up in one of these very religious homes that made you really worry about it? We got a couple of people. Yeah, a bunch of people in the room. There is something about that experience for most of us that makes us really shy away from the... There's a word that shows up in the 12 steps way too much for a guy like me. God. That idea that there is somehow, some way, I'm supposed to like get all dialed in with God. And that's tough sledding. And yet, according to this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, the whole point... You know, there's a chapter in the book called There Is a Solution. The title of the chapter is a promise in itself, isn't it? Really. Solution. And you have to look for it. Wilson doesn't really make it very easy, but the solution that he mentions in that chapter is the formation of a relationship with God. Well, I don't really leap to that, you know. Not because I'm lazy and I don't want to take the steps. Not because I'm all annoyed at those religious people. I am, but that isn't what keeps me from it. And I think Bob said something about being a seeker. I don't remember if you said this or not. I've been touched by God in such a way that nothing less will ever do. That whole idea that we are not here because we came here out of failure and not out of virtue. We come here because we have no place else to go. We come here because we're drunks. We come here, as Bob said, because for us. There is no sufficiently strong reason that'll keep me from drinking. That I might stop for a day or two or three, but I never quit. It isn't in me to quit. First time I decided I was going to quit, I went 6 weeks without drinking. And I told everybody I quit. I quit drinking. I told my wife, I told my commanding officer in the Marine Corps. I was stationed at Camp Pendleton at the time. I told my the base psychiatrist, who turned out to be a dermatologist, but I told him anyway. yeah. I told the minister in town, and 6 weeks later, I'm drunker than I've ever been. And people said, like, I thought you quit. So, the next time I decided to quit, I didn't tell anybody. Let that be your little secret. You got less explanation to do. But the difference between me and a heavy drinker, I think fundamentally, is I can't quit. I'm just dead in the water about that quitting part. And there's nothing in the steps that asks me to quit. You'd think if it was about quitting, they'd tell you. Step one, quit. Knock it off. God damn it, knock that shit off. Come on. feel better than that. I mean, frothy emotional appeal would get the job done. Your mother and I are worried sick about you. Oh, really? Well, that'll do it. The kids have been asking about. I'll bet they have. There's no quitting. And when that bail bondsman brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, after a rather, well, I didn't drink that long. I started drinking when I was 16 years old at a party after a football game. And I loved it. I loved it from the gate. I knew this was important stuff to me. I knew it. I was 16, and I hadn't been breathing very deeply for a while because 2 years earlier I'd stood at the low rent part of the cemetery in Billings, and they buried my mom, and I was mad at my mom, and I got this attitude, and I'm a nasty little kid, and I'm thinking, you don't love me, I don't love you either. But I stopped breathing deeply that day. 2 years later, they gave me a little bit of vodka after a football game at a party. Thirteen years go by, and I'm living in a garage. I called it a garage, a double garage over in Glendale. And it turned out it wasn't even a garage. Linda, my wife, and I were over there a few years ago. She said, I want to see the garage. And we went down in there. She said, is that, pointed it out to her. She said, is that it? And I said, yes. Yeah. She said, I got news for you. That's not a garage. That's a shed is what that is. And I looked, and by God, no car had ever gotten in that place. It's just a little shed. It's a shed. And four of us lived in that place. Smelled bad in there. I had a wet mattress on a cot, and I had a... That was about it. No decorations on the wall. A little chilly, but nothing that... I had a radio that kept playing all the time. Pull a plug out of the wall and the radio just going on. Yeah, Magic Radio, that's right. Had an old copy of Playboy magazine, too. That was my social life in that little room there. There was no magic there, I'll tell you. Honey, I'm home. You know, I got a little thin. It's just 13 years have gone by. What had started at a party was done. The party was over. The party was over, and it had been over for a while. And I got an interesting experience of a bail bondsman taking me to the Glendale Alano Club. And I was around here for a couple of weeks. And I ran across some amphetamines and some cash on the same day, and that requires a drink. And I was gone for a few more days, weeks. And I got back to AA, walked back, got to that club one Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. I say Saturday, I don't know what day of the week it was. It was the 14th of August. The year was 1966, and the guy there in that club that day asked me if I was alcoholic, because I'd said I'd gotten drunk. And he said, oh, are you alcoholic? I don't know. I don't know. But I had to stay there that day. I needed to be in that club that day. I had warrants out for my arrest. I didn't. And so I said to him, as I remember it, I said, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Been an alcoholic about a month now, is what I told him. You know, it's like, I'm a mild case. I won't be any trouble to you. He brightened right up. She said, so you're an alcoholic and you got drunk. I said, yeah. He said, alcoholics do that. He said, in fact, I'll tell you a little secret. If you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, you're going to drink no matter what. You will drink no matter what. And I knew he was right. I drink no matter what. I'll tell you I'm not going to drink. I'll tell you I'm going to stop for one or two, or I'll pick up the kids, or I'll bring the check home. None of that happens. I drink. He said, good people in AA will tell you don't drink no matter what, and you will drink no matter what. And there's something, I got it. I really understood it that day. I got it. I am hopeless. I am hopeless. I will always drink. And that was the last day I drank. Something happened to me that day. And I didn't do it. I didn't do it. And I was goofy. I love being down here and being on the in the shadow of the pagan splendor of Norwalk. When I was 9 months sober, they said, there was a group that was in the back of the room, and they collected there on one Monday night a month. The Monday, I had the job of setting up the chairs in the Monday night meeting. Oh, God, I loved that job. I loved it. Made me feel like I had a right to take up a chair of my own, you know. I asked about that little group. They said, oh, that's the institutional committee. I said, what does that mean? Well, they take the message to hospitals, jail. And lo and behold, one night they asked me if I would go with them to a meeting, an institutional meeting. I don't even think I was supposed to be going there at 9 months of sobriety. And we went down to the parking lot. We got in Bill Christian's old Chrysler. Six of us, five of those people that I had admired so much, and I'm sitting in the back seat in the middle on the hump. We get on the freeway and we head down the five and we get off at whatever it was in those days, Norwalk or Pioneer. I said, what are we doing? Well, we're going to put the meeting on here. And we went through a gate and there was this cyclone fence and there's some brick buildings. And I said, where are we going to do the meeting? And somebody said, in that building right over there, that's the Nut House. I'm fine with that until we get out of the car. And then it hit me. Why are we going? What the? And then I got it. Six of us are going in that Nut House. Five of them are coming back out of that. And I'm like, I can outrun any one of these old fools, you know. I can be over a cyclone fence in a heartbeat. But something had me walking along with you. A weird thought came to me. The beginning of some kind of recovery. The thought is, if they think I belong in that Nut House, maybe I do. Maybe I do. And I just kept walking with them. And we went inside, and the orderly brought down a bunch of patients. Blue slippers, white robes. I'm thinking, I can't look cool wearing that. An hour went by, and we all walked out into that warm California evening. And we all got in Bill Christian's old car. And we drove back to Glendale. And I slept in my little bed that night. And I've never forgotten. There's never been a step. There's never been a surrender. There's never been any kind of interaction that I've had with members of Alcoholics Anonymous that has been anything but healing to me. There's been plenty that I have been slow to do. I haven't leapt with glad cries to a whole lot of this over the years. I was afraid to take those steps. I was afraid to do it. Because my childhood experience told me that there is nothing about a relationship with God that's good news. And if that's the point of taking the steps, I'm screwed. I'm just screwed. My uncle went down to the front of that church in Billings, Montana one morning and got saved. And they sent him to China to be a missionary. That'll keep you away from the front of the church, I'll tell you. Like, wow. And I knew he wasn't having any fun over there, and it's not cool. And the people that seemed to be buying into that whole thing in the Church of the Air in Billings when I was a little boy were not happy people, from my point of view. And it's not true. It's not, you know, there were plenty of people that found a lot in that church. But I was not one of them, and I scanned and could always see the ones that were unhappy there. It wasn't true. But I had an interesting experience not long ago, maybe last week, 2 weeks ago, that kind of points up the difference in a sense to me. I'm on the airplane to Washington, D.C., and I happened to sit next to a pastor, a minister, two of them. They were flying back from L.A. to, they were going to wind up in North Carolina, in Keith's home state. And these were nice people. They were nice guys. And they were both totally involved in a church. And as pastors will do, especially in fundamentalist churches, the one that was sitting next to me, when I asked him what he did, he said he told me what I just told you. And he asked me about what church I went to. And I said, well, I really don't go to church. He said, well, what about your relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ, which is familiar language to me? And I said, you know, I'm not sure I have one, but I have a relationship with God. Well, that makes them nervous. You know, they're not used to that kind of... And I said, it seemed to me I went right to headquarters, you know. Because on the 14th of August, 1966, over 35 years ago, a power greater than mine removed the obsession to drink. I didn't do that. I did not do that. And the obsession has not come back. And if you've had an occasional thought of a drink and didn't drink, that's not an obsession. The difference between thinking about drinking and having an obsession is the way you smell. When it's on me, I drink. I just drink. And you hang on moment by moment by, and then you figure, oh God, I'm going to drink eventually. Why am I going through all of this? You know. It was taken from me. It was taken from me in a moment. I surrendered. I stepped. Took one little step. The fear of the unknown was less than the fear of the known that day. And I didn't drink. I began the process of what I call the quiet miracle of a sober life. And I didn't know I had begun that process. I had no credibility with myself, but I have over the years developed a relationship with God because I finally went through these steps. And when this minister said, what do you mean you have a relationship with God? I told him, he and I are close. He's in me and I'm in him. He said, well, what about that church when you were a kid? I said, the church is still in me. I'm not in the church anymore, but the church is in me. And I have been touched in such a way by God that nothing less will do. And I looked for it and had that itch and that yearning for it after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, do you study the Bible? I said, no. No, I don't. And he spent a little time trying to talk to me about studying the Bible, as ministers do, because that's where he comes from. A non-alcoholic, God-fearing, good, good human being was reaching out to me to talk to me about studying the Bible. I said, I don't do that. And then he wanted to know, he asked an interesting question. He said, well, when you die and you meet God, what are you going to say when God asks you why he should let you into his heaven? And I said, my God wouldn't ask that question. And it would be way late anyway because he let me into his heaven 35 years ago. And I didn't hear anything from him for about 30 minutes this morning. And he's kind of like, And I didn't want that to be the end of the conversation because I didn't want him to feel bad about, you know, or feel like I'd been too cute for words or anything like that. Yeah, a glib, smart answer. really wasn't it at all, but I had, and I wanted him to know that I had told him absolutely how I see it. How I see it. Now, how do I get from that terrible fear of God to a place where I have him as my friend? I heard a wonderful thing one time. I was up in Reno, and Father Terry was speaking. Yeah, he gives a great talk, if you ever get... And he... I went up to him, and we were talking, and a cowboy came up and said, "I drove clear across the state of Nevada, Father Terry, to hear you talk." And Father Terry said, "How was your trip?" He said, "Good trip. Good trip. God came with me." He said, "No kidding." He said, "Yeah, he got in that pickup right around Elko someplace and just came right on in." That's great. That's great. And Terry said, "What did you find out about God?" He said, "Well, he's real smart." I mean, the guy had an experience, you know. And I know he did, because the next question that Father Terry said was, "What else did you find out about God?" And this old cowboy said, "He's not pissed off. He's not mad." And I spent a lifetime thinking he was. But, you know, you look back at that day, and we all have it, a day. We say a birthday. But something happened to us that we could not possibly have brought about in ourselves. And you have to get a little curious about that. And you have to wonder, how long do I have to live alone? And how long will my demons chew at me? And how long will I be skeptical and cynical and cute? How long will I know with everything in me that I have to do it all myself? Because when, you know, that's really the problem. It's all up to me. And so the day came, and it came out of a deep failure in my life. A deep failure, a failure that was so bad financially and in every other way that I really knew the next thing I'd be doing would be pushing a grocery cart around the streets of Los Angeles. And I'd been sober a number of years. I had been sober long enough to get a career going. I was 9 years sober, and I, amazingly, the state of California gave me a license to practice law. They wouldn't give me a license to drive when I got here, so we're making it. And I needed some power, so I did that. And I'm practicing law, and I'm doing all that. And it all... It seemed like my life just collapsed around me, and it's a tedious story that I'm not going to get into here with you, but it got me so frightened and so aware that if there is not something more in AA than this cynicism about God, I really am in deep trouble. And about that time, fell in with some guys that were doing these steps out of the book, and I went through this process, and it's about that I will share with you a little bit. There's 12 of these steps. And the first one, the principle of the first step, is honesty. I really have to get it about the fact that I'm powerless over alcohol. Okay, that's not a reach for me. But what's a terrible reach for me is the fact that my life has become unmanageable. And it is today, after 35 years here. And that just is a lot of living. And a lot of failing. You know, when you're new, you look at a guy taking 5 years and he's talking about having marriage problems, and you know, if I ever get 5 years, all that is going to be, I'll be dialed in about that marriage thing, I'll tell you that. And then you get 5 years and you go, wow, I wonder how that guy got to be doing so good at 5 years. Yeah. You don't suppose he surrendered, do you? You don't suppose he stopped managing his life? No, that can't be it. It can't be that. It's not going to be that. It's not going to be that. And you go on, and every once in a while you wake. You know, we hate to wake up. I love sleeping. I love sleeping. I'll take a time out and tell you a story told by a guy named Tony DeMello, who is kind of a mystic, and he's dead now, but he's an interesting guy. And he talked about a woman that pulled up to the Thames River in London one cold evening. She was in a limousine, wealthy, wealthy woman. And she stepped out of the limo, and there was a guy, one of us, laying there under the bridge, newspaper wrapped around him, cold, dark, foggy evening. And she said, "My good man, what are you doing here?" And he said, "I stay here." She said, "You stay here? This is terribly bitter cold, and you stay?" He said, "Yeah, I do." She said, "Not tonight. I'm going to have my man take you out." And this guy was in a dream when this woman came up to him. He had laid down to tuck in for the night. He fell asleep and he started dreaming. And the lady really came up to him in his dream. She said, "I'm going to take you out. I'm going to have my man take you out to my estate at the edge of London, and they'll put you up for the night." And he couldn't believe his luck. And exactly that happened. And the lady woke up about midnight, and she couldn't get back to sleep. She decided to walk around her estate, this beautiful woman, peignoir wrapped around her. She went down in the servants' quarters, saw a light coming under the door of one of the rooms, and knew that they had put the new guy in there. She knocked on the door. He said, "Come in." He wasn't sleeping either. She said, "How you doing?" He said, "Oh, I thank you so much." She said, "Looks like you got a shave and a haircut and clean clothes." "Yes." "You got some food?" "Yes." "You're warm?" "Yes." "I really appreciate it." She stepped inside. She said, "Do you want some company for the night?" He said, "Oh my God, yeah." And she shut the door and she started to walk toward the bed, and he moved over in the bed to make room for her, and he fell right into the River Thames. We hate to wake up, you know, we just sleep through it all. And so I got that remarkable wake-up call of total failure. Total failure. Before I forget to tell you, none of it was irretrievable, and the law practice was, it was just that all of my constant trying to manage my life and make money and do all of that had just fallen down around my ears. My partner came to me and said, "I don't want to play with you anymore." The lady I was with said goodbye. The house went on the market. The car was gone. And I was in an absolute mess. Moved down to some little scruffy apartment and started over in sobriety. Started over. And I guess I was struggling for about 6 months. And then an amazing thing happened. A guy came along and said, "I'll take you through the steps." And we began. And so it wasn't hard for me at that point in my life to get that my life had become unmanageable. It wasn't really hard for me. It wasn't. At step two, I had trouble with this sanity thing. Restored to sanity. You know, I play at a pretty high level. I'm trying lawsuits to juries all the time downtown. I'm doing this, I'm doing that. Sanity. And he said, "Why don't you write down the craziest things you ever did in your life? However many there are." He said, "Write 20. I don't know how many I wrote, but I went back to him with my list. And he read the list and he said, "This is crazy stuff." I said, "Yeah, a lot of it around drinking, yeah." He said, "But you didn't write down the craziest thing you ever did." And I said, "Well, what is that?" He said, "You did it repeatedly." I said, "Yeah, what is that?" He said, "The craziest thing you ever did, you did between two drunks." "Yeah? Yeah. With all this evidence in your life that you should never drink again, and between every two drunks, when you weren't drinking and had no booze in your system, you decided it'd be a good idea to take another drink. That's crazy. And you brought that mind into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, can we get on to step three?" But we had a little more work to do. There's a weird question. A rude question. Is God everything or nothing? Right there in the middle of step two. Step two. The principle for step two is hope. And they ask you questions like, what will your answer be? Is God everything or nothing? Well, I know he's not nothing, but I don't think he's everything. Well, then we're going to ask it a little differently. What five things will you not give up for a better relationship with God? Oh, I've got five things. Even after that deep failure and that great fear, I don't want to give up my career. I don't want to give up sex. I don't want to give up anger. I don't want to give up control. There were about seven things. He said, great, at least we're telling the truth about that. So at step three, we're going to ask you to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of number eight on a list of eight. Is that it? Yeah, that's pretty much it. You think you're going to do that? No. No, you can't, because you've been going to those top seven things for your power. And we've known forever you can't do that and live a life of peace and happiness and joy and service. Even in the Old Testament, remember that? Moses came down, brought the list. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Those were my gods. That's what I worshipped. I worshipped my own greed and my own lust and money, and that's where I went for power. And I can't live that way. In fact, he came down. It was interesting. He gathered that crowd around him. And Moses said, I got good news and bad. What do you want first? They said, give us the good news. He said, well, I got him down to 10. What's the bad news? He said, adultery's still on the list. A little humor thrown in. There's no charge for this. Well, this is not step six time when you are willing to give things, but there is a way to reprioritize that, and that's for another day. But when the process got done at step two, and because of God's grace in my life, there was nothing more important to me than a better relationship with God. And from there, making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God was okay. And it wasn't about blind faith. I had a lot of evidence by then. If you're new and we talk about faith, we never ask for blind faith. You have all the evidence you'll ever need, and you'll get more and more every day. But just the fact we're sober is a lot of evidence that God's grace is operative. But where and how are we going to find this power? And then they give the answer. Typically, Wilson sets up the question at page 45, answers it at page 55, and he says, the great reality is deep within. Well, how can that be? I'm not a fitting host for God. How can he be living in me? And it turns out that he is. And then the question is there a place inside me where I can go where God is? That's a key deal, because there is a statement in this book that says we're entitled to absolute certainty. It doesn't say it quite like that, but it says the central fact of our lives is the absolute certainty that our Creator has come to be with us. Absolute certainty. And I knew I would die without absolute certainty. I would mostly live my life on hope and anger. And one day, in the middle of a trial, in San Diego, California, I'm in a hotel room. I'm going to walk across the street to the courthouse. And I got this book, and I'm praying, and I'm saying the last sentence in chapter 2 says, when we drew near to him, he revealed himself to us. And I said, well, reveal yourself. I need you. And I'll tell you something, he's not boggled by my annoyance. And that day, that morning in a hotel room in San Diego, I went inside and found a place inside me where I can go where God is. And it changed the game so much. And everybody has his own experience, and when you meet God, you're going to meet him alone. And I did. And I'd been sober a long time. And I'd been hungry a long time. And I'd been walking alone a long, long time. And I could, and the whole point of these steps is to form a relationship. And I'd never had a relationship with anybody. Except my mom when I was 4 years old, and that all ended badly. I'd had arrangements. You know, there's a big difference between an arrangement and a relationship. And you can't have an arrangement with God. You don't sign on for no arrangements. I mean, an arrangement is like a contract, you know. You do this, I'll do that. Arrangement is so you can keep score. An arrangement is for security. Not a relationship. A relationship has a covenant to it, a sacredness to it. It's for growth. It doesn't always go easily at all. But it isn't about, you don't ever change. It's about, she's changing, I'm changing, this and that. I'm always, and the reason that the fundamental relationship is with God is because that stays put. Not the relationship, but my God is my God. Now you go into you know why you turn your will and your life over the care of God? I think it's because you got to do steps 4 through 9. And 4 through 9 are contrary to my will and against my life. And if I don't turn my will and my life over the care of God at step 3, I am going to bag out on 4 and 5 and so on. And so I did that. Now I had to get going. I looked at step 4. They want you to write down everything, everybody and everything and every institution you resent. Isn't it weird? Why would Wilson start with resentments? That seemed like an odd place to start. We get these trumpeters around the nation in our history that say, you show me how a man treats his children and I'll tell you who he is. Wilson says, show me what pisses you off and I'll let you know who you are. All right. Well, plenty. You list them all. But the thing is, I think it's a power analysis. Who do I resent? I resent people that have power. I mean, if you don't have any power or look to me like you have power, I may dismiss you, but I won't resent you. I can get to sleep at night. Who am I afraid of? That's another part of that image. I'm afraid of people with power. What institutions make me resentful? What principles? Those that have power over me. Why else would I be mad at the Marine Corps, mad at the IRS, mad at the dental school at Oregon that threw me out? So it's about how have I played the power game? Who do I resent? And then the sex inventory. How have I played that? Where have I tried to extract power out of a situation that's not a legitimate source of power? And we look at that and we read it to somebody and we're getting some wake-up calls now. And then we list the character defects. We look at the areas how did I get her to do that? My wife left me. Yeah? How'd you get her to do that? I got fired. How long did it take you? 2 weeks? Wow. You were working at it. You insisted on getting your ass run out the door. Wow. That whole thing. And those are based on some old ideas and some crazy thinking and some character defects and all of that. And we don't really have time to get into it, but I'll tell you something. At step 6, we list that stuff, and then we ask some questions. Do I have a God? Am I done with this? Am I done with thinking that I can't trust women? Am I done with that? Will there be some power that'll take that idea away from me? My whole life is based on two ideas about women. I am afraid of them, and I'm fascinated by them. And you know, there's no place to go with all of that. I can't be a partner. Why? She has all that power. What power? Yes, no power. That's what she's got. Yeah, so, with that kind of power, I've got this uneasy truth. She's got the approval power. You know, we're addicted to a drug called approval, and then we marry our dealer, for Christ's sakes. But these steps change your God. This change is fundamental. Anybody that knew me during that time looked and looked again. And you're calming down. Wow. I've always sponsored guys, always. And I found myself really praying that their marriage would work. I stopped seeing their wives as somebody that was just interfering with our deal. Yeah. She wants you to come home once in a while? Nah! So, it's important after we get through that, and we, you know, if these character defects that I have, if I'm really willing to let them go, the only question is the God that I'm in relationship with big enough to take them? There's one little question right after that, and that is this: will he do that for me? Well, by now I knew he loved me. I knew that. And I knew he was a big guy. And I knew he'd do it for me. And he did. He took out so much of that. Not everything I wanted gone, but the things that got in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows and to me, that went. And it doesn't take him long. You know, he doesn't mull it over. He doesn't. Can you imagine? Well, let's see. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a day that we call a birthday, would we? I mean, he just, okay, you got it. Boom. And we don't know that. Our mind doesn't get that. It takes a while. Some of them went on to other people, but some stayed. And of those that stayed, some of them wanted to go through the steps too, and some of them were a paragraph behind me in the book as we went through it. And I watched them grow. I got a front row seat to the extraordinary experience of another human being emerging. Something precious out of that which appeared to have no value. And we laughed and we cried, and somebody would show up at my office at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, and another guy at 9 and 10 and 11. And Sunday morning was the same. And there was such a joy in it. And I got at step 9, I got on an airplane to Roanoke and knelt at my father's grave. I got on the plane to Denver and sat with my sister. I went to Portland and sat with my brother. I went to Atlanta, my little brother, who died 4 years ago pushing a cart in Atlanta. I found him. And we talked. And I made amends to him. And the ultimate question when you're making amends is the last question. What can I do to set it right? And they will tell you. They will tell you. He said, leave me alone. I said, I don't know if I can do that. And I would go out there and hunt him down, talk to him. He didn't want to see me. He wanted to be angry, you know, because we came from a rather colorful home. And he wanted the world to know how badly he had been treated. He wasn't an alcoholic. He just died lonely and afraid and terrified and beat up. And I miss him. I miss him. I finally had to go back to my mother's grave in Billings. Oh, I was afraid to go in that grave, that cemetery. I knelt there in the low, low rent part of that cemetery. And her name was there, the year she was born, the year she died, separated by a dash that represents a life. I don't know how to talk to my mom. I've been angry at her for so long. She would beat me and beat me and beat me. She could make me mow the lawn if she beat me enough. She couldn't make me clip around the sidewalk. My little line in the sand. And that day in that cemetery in Billings, Montana, 40 years after she died, I had been wandering in the far country for 40 years. Somebody, an Al-Anon, a good friend of mine, who was also in Billings that weekend, gave me a shopping bag full of things. She said, you're going to need these out in the cemetery. And in it was some Kleenex and some paper towels and some shears, some seeds, and a liter of water, flower seeds. And I finally, after several hours of just being there at my mother's grave, said, I don't know how this goes, but I had the shears and I can at least clip around her grave marker. And when I did, the tears just started. It's like, and I got it, you know, the thing I wouldn't do. I surrendered to whatever. Words like obedience have been creeping into my life. I didn't cry all my tears that day, but I went out the next day and I cried my tears. And I came out of that cemetery the second day knowing that I could always trust her, that she always loved me, and I had built a life on knowing that she didn't love me and I couldn't trust her. Now that changes the deal. Linda came into my life after that. After that. When I was a little boy, my mom and I played before it hit the fan in our house. She'd tuck me in and we'd whisper our secrets and we would laugh and carry on when she tucked me into bed. And one day with Linda, after we married, we were laughing and carrying on, giggling and being silly in the bedroom, in bed. And I realized this is how it was. It was so sweet. And it's sweet again. And it's because of these steps, and it's because of God's grace. It's because finally I said, okay, I'll do whatever the hell you want me to do. You want me to go to China? I'll go to China. He didn't want me in China. Stay in town and pay child support, you know. And I watch these guys go through and they get to step 9. You can't do step 9 because you don't have any power. And they know it and they're scared. And by the time we get to step 9, they start on an easy one and an easy one. And then I'm willing to do that. It's amazing. It's amazing. Tom is a sweet guy that I watched go through that process. Tom is he's a window washer and he's a burglar. It's a nice... I mean, he knows where to go back at night, right? And he had 13 homes in South Pasadena that he had burglarized while he was drinking. 13 that he could remember. And he knew. I didn't have to tell him. He knew. The only question was whether he could. And the prayer changes. It changes to take me to my next amends and give me the power to make it. Give me the power to make it. The principle of step 9 is atonement. And he started knocking on those doors, generally getting a good reception. He was a felon, so he could have gone to jail at any time. There was one, and he called me up one day. He said, I got to go over there. I got to do this. It's the last one on my list. And listen, let me just tell you that there's a huge difference between making all your amends and making all but four. Big difference. And this was his last. He'd been there once, and they weren't home. He parked his truck out there again one day, and he couldn't get out of his truck. He couldn't go. I said, you want me to go with you? He said, no, I'll go. I said, call me when you're done. He called me. I said, how'd it go? And I didn't have to ask because I heard it in his voice. He was free. I said, what happened? He said, it's an older couple that lived there. And I asked him, did you live here 6 years ago when your home was burglarized? And he said, oh, yeah. He said, I did that. And I came here to make that right with you. And they had a few questions for him, like, why? And why are you here? He said, I'm married now. I have a little girl. I, I want to be free and I want to live a sweet life. And I need to clean this up. And they invited him in and they asked him more, why'd you break the mirror on the wife? I thought there was a safe behind that mirror. Why did you do that? Why did? And after a while they believed that he did that. And the cookies came out and some milk. And they're doing pretty good. But he has to ask that last question, what can I do to set this right? And they said, you've done that. He said, I don't think so. How do you mean that? And this couple said, until right now, we always thought our son had done that. And a family healed up, and Tom got free. And I watched another miracle. And I'll tell you, this book has got such magic and power in it, and these steps, and people do recover. Somebody put together a little thing for me, not for me, but just put it together. And it's sort of like the backdrop of the bedevilments and the promises. This is a list on page 52. It says, we were having trouble with personal relationships. And on page 83, 31 pages later, it says, we will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Page 52, we couldn't control our emotional natures. Page 83, we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. 52, we were prey to misery and depression. 83, our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. We couldn't make a living. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We had a feeling of uselessness. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We were full of fear. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. We were unhappy. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. No matter, it says it in the book, no matter how far down the scale we've gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. We will not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. And most of all, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Extravagant stuff, isn't it? And it happens. It happens. And it happens however you are doing this thing. It isn't. There's no formula to it. Just don't do it your way. So, it's a great treat to be here with you and with these Giants said, I love so much these men that are here, and if you have a question, we can do it. Otherwise, we'll take a break. Yeah. Cynthia. I just think that stuff up. If you want to know what the other principles are, I'll be glad to tell you. Just occurs to me at night. I can't sleep well because I worry. No, I can't. Anybody else? Good. Let's have a break. Good. Good job. Thank you.